to 37. Belinda June Yankton's blue eyes snapped wide open, but she knew where she was. She was long over wishing or hoping that the next time would be different, that she would wake up in her bed, the sheets cool against her brown skin, happily sore from sex, the smell of eggs, frying bacon, and fresh ground coffee beans filling up her head. She did sometimes find herself hoping her dreams would never end. Her dreams had never meant so much to her before, nor had they seemed so very real. Dreams had come to be where she did her real living these days. Just before opening her eyes, she'd been snorkeling above a coral reef. The water was so clear that if she turned to look up at the surface, she could make out individual flames on the face of the sun. Its warmth reached through the light teal tint of the world, surrounding her like her daddy's arms. But it had been the fishes that captured her attention. There were thousands of them, millions of them, in all shapes and sizes. And their eyes were not passive fish eyes, cold and unfeeling. Some of them, the little silvery ones with the iridescent skins and rainbow speckles, had black eyelashes, long and fluttery. Some, the big blue-skinned tunas, had lips and spoke to her, not in words, but in thoughts. They asked a lot of questions, tunas did. She had answered them as best she could. Then she was out of the teal water, and in the world of her own foul-smelling sweat. She had come to accept that whatever remained of her life would be lived out strapped to a workbench, suffering through bouts of the chills as she came out of her dreams. The first few weeks when she'd awaken like this, the horror of her situation would come rushing back in so that it took her breath away and she'd break down. That had passed, the crying and choking into her gag, the begging and bargaining. He had told her he would teach her things about herself that she didn't know she was capable of. He was right about that. About a week ago, after he'd washed her down and loosened her gag, she had offered herself to him. He just snickered and said, "They always do that, offer themselves to me." He said that phrase a lot, not the last part, the first part. "They always say that. They always do that." She didn't like thinking about how many times he had done this sort of thing before. Then he refixed her gag and stroked her hair. She hated herself for it, but she had come to like it when he stroked her hair. It made her feel human. It was something to hang on to. It gave her hope that he connected to her somehow. She might as well have wished for the talking tuna to be real. The only time he seemed even vaguely human was when she'd said she was sorry for spilling his beer in his lap. That opaque look in his eyes cleared, and the perpetual smirk vanished from his face. "You know," he said, "I think you actually mean it." She did. That was last week. Maybe not. It might have been yesterday. She had lost track of time. When you're strapped to a table like she was, and likely to be tortured to death, losing time is a way to keep the little bits of sanity left to you. She knew she had been there for many weeks, at least. That was all she was sure of. He had been drugging her constantly of late, which was fine with her, but it completely discombobulated her, and sometimes she felt she had lost whole days to unconsciousness. She lifted her head off the table and reflexively tried to stretch the weariness out of her arms. It was ridiculous, of course, restrained as she was, but it was easier for her to accept her plight than for her reflexes. Only this time there was some give when she pulled her right arm toward her chest. At first, after feeling the give in the strap, she lay absolutely still, listening for signs of him. Nothing. Only the buzz of traffic, which had become the droning soundtrack to her captivity. Then she yanked her right arm again. More give. She girded herself, focused every ounce of strength and energy she had left into her right hand and arm. She counted to herself, 1, 2, 3. Her right arm was free, snapping forward so hard her hand slammed into her chest. She held her hand up and studied the frayed end of the leather strap. It must have torn from her weeks and weeks of pulling against it, and it rubbing against a sharp edge. She gathered herself, then twisted her body so she could use her right hand to undo the left-hand restraint. After about an hour, she was free, but spent. He had kept her hydrated and fed her a protein bar or two a day, but she was weak and she collapsed to the concrete floor when she tried standing. She could not afford to wait and gather herself again. She had to get out of there before he got back. By the time she rolled out the front door, her knees, forearms, shins, and elbows were raw and bloodied, but she barely felt the pain. It was bright and kiln hot. The street she was on was deserted and dimly lit. She crawled across the burning hot pavement to the opposite side of the street, then pulled herself to her feet. She needed to get her bearings, to get some sense of where she was and where she could go. And when she steadied herself as best she could on legs wobbly as a newborn calf's, she recognized a landmark in the near distance. It was hard to miss its huge white tubular arch jutting up 400 feet into the pale blue Texas sky, and its splayed mass of taut cables giving the impression of an otherworldly stringed instrument. The Margaret Hunt Hill Bridge, or, as everyone in town called it, Large Marge. It was no more than a mile away. She'd always thought it a hideous-looking thing, but at just that moment it was the most beautiful thing she had ever seen. She fell to her knees and wept.